Welcome to Spill Radio. This program is being recorded on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people. I am Tatiana Melma, hosting this program on behalf of the Morrison Helen Belkin Art Gallery at the University of British Columbia. Spill Radio is presented in collaboration with CITR 101.9 FM, with sound production and editing by Joshua Stevenson. Today's episode includes a talk by Maria Teresa Alves, recorded on October 18th. This was presented by SFU Galleries in collaboration with the City of Vancouver's Public Art Program as part of their speaker series, Dialogues on Art in Publics. During her visit to Vancouver, Alves was also a participant in the Belkin Art Gallery Spill Response, a live research and performance component of the exhibition Spill. Since the 1980s, Alves has produced a body of work that investigates the circumstances of specific localities worldwide in order to give witness to silenced histories. Her research-based art develops out of interactions with the physical and social environments, responding to local needs and proceeding through a process of dialogue facilitated by direct involvement with material, environmental, and social circumstances. Alves explores spaces of agency and visibility.
A Full Void was commissioned by Frestis Triennale. It was called Between Post-Truths and Events in 2017 in Sorocaba, in the state of São Paulo in Brazil, and it was curated by Daniela Labra. Sorocaba is a city located in the state of São Paulo, and it was founded by a bandeirante. And it's a bit different than the makeup in the U.S. and Canada. Their principal activities were enslaving indigenous peoples, followed by the ensuing genocide of indigenous people as a result of the usurpation of lands and resources. And these killers are celebrated in Brazil as heroes and have a national holiday in their honor, November the 11th. It's coming up. Universities, highways, hospitals, flower shops are named after them. In the hotel I stayed at during my research, the meeting room was named in their honor. Sala Bandeirante. My morning coffee has, you can't quite see, oh yeah, maybe you can. This is their Borba Gato, that's a bandeirante. Okay. So the long-term presence of indigenous peoples in the history of the city is relegated to a few pots, funerary urns, and ceramic shards of some distant past. The only remains of much that was destroyed as a result of the invasion. These are displayed in the City Museum, which is housed in the local zoo. Okay. So this painting is of the founding myth. These pots here have very little information on the museum labels. There's no interest in the city to study this history. So that's how I began, is how does the city see themselves? So I was interested in that, and then I said, okay, now I want to visit where the historical, political, social, and economic lives of the city takes place. So I went to the piazza, the central piazza, and which was pretty gruesome. So we have a monument, a statue of the founding father killer, and then we have over there, so he's here, and over there, which is over here in the piazza, is a plaque to the father of modern Brazilian historical scholarship, Mr. Van Hagen. Then here we have the piazza, which is in honor of the founder of the military police of the state of São Paulo. And there we have the justice building, a court justice. And here we have the shopping mall. It used to be this area was all these huge stones. This is all that one stone remains. So I then thought it would be important that ceramic pots be placed on these sites because the only thing we have is ceramic pots. There's nothing else that is there that is testimony. So I first spoke with the Guarani community in São Paulo, as Sorocaba is a city in São Paulo state, to see who might make some. There are no indigenous ceramicists in São Paulo, although there are several accomplished basketry makers. I then spoke with Maximino Rodriguez, a Guarani, a teacher and a leader from the Jaguaypiru Reservation in Dourados in the state over, Mato Grosso do Sul. There was no one there who made ceramics either, but he offered to learn and make them. He began his research by interviewing the elders of the reservation. He explained that many wept as they remembered the traditional ceramic making process that made up part of their cultural patrimony, which is no longer practiced. The main economic activity of São Paulo during its first 200 years was the direct sale of enslaved indigenous people. There is this myth about the coffee. That's a myth that came afterwards. The money to make that came from the sale of enslaved indigenous people. And people were captured from the Atlantic coast all the way to the frontier with Argentina and Paraguay, and then even further north. So entire communities, when confronted with these assaults, would flee. Anything that was heavy was left behind. So after hundreds of years of this fleeing, little effort was spent on making objects which cannot be easily carried, and thus ceramics ceased to be manufactured eventually. Rodriguez saw the bringing back of the art of ceramic making as an act of resistance. He taught himself with the help of elders to find the appropriate clay, dig it up, clean it, then make the ceramics, and finally fire them. The ceramic elements the public saw in Sorocaba were the result of this revitalization of Guarani culture. These ceramics made by Rodriguez were then placed semi-buried in these public spaces throughout the city, parking lots, shopping centers, and parks, sidewalks, and the university. The work was an attempt to question the denial of the indigenous presence and the history of the making of Sorocaba. So I'd like to go back to the making of the ceramics, because this caused a very interesting problem for me to try to figure out how to deal with. So first there was, as there were no ceramicists, as a result of colonization in São Paulo, I requested that SESC, who was funding the Triennale, and it's an amazing organization, I forgot what it stands for, but it's a type of union of all people who work in commerce. So if you sell bubblegum, you're in this union, and if you sell Maseratis, you're in this union. It's one union. And a small amount of money goes into making a SESC, which is like a cultural center. And they try to figure out what the community needs. And in this SESC, for example, there's a dentist office, because the health insurance normally doesn't cover dentistry. So then you have that there. They have a swimming pool, they have a gym and everything. Those are only for union members. But then they have a public programs, and their public programs are usually very good. So I asked Sesky to finance a workshop to be given by Michele Vargas and Maximino Rodriguez at the Calapete Reservation at the invitation of Gera Pires de Lima in São Paulo. Sesky wanted to know if they were to receive ceramic pieces in exchange. I said that was up to the participants of the workshop, but I did not know. And then Sesky said that they saw no reason to finance the workshop. I explained that it could be seen as reparation payments, perhaps, because it was the result of the enslavement practices by the founder of their city that resulted in the lack of Guarani ceramicists in São Paulo. Explained to that way, Sesky agreed. Okay, the next element was a workshop that would result in the making of a short video interviews that you can see the little small monitors there with the headphones. This was a result of a three-day workshop with indigenous students in the bachelor program of UFSCar, the Federal University of San Carlos, and this was part of the work process. During the first day, I had all of this translated into Portuguese, right? We read texts by indigenous intellectuals such as Linda Tuhuiwe Smith, Richard Hill, Candace Hopkins, Joy Harjo, Jared McMasters, Simon Ortiz, Vine Deloria, among others. On the second day, we looked at the works of artists such as Rebecca Belmore, Ruth Cuthan, Edward Poitras, Nicolas Galalin, Jimmy Durham, Minerva Cuevas, Abraham Cruz Villegas, Mike Kai Tubbs, Shelley Nero, Jeffrey Gibson, Edgar Hippobirds, Kent Monkman, Daniel Guzman, Francisco Toledo, Cisco Jimenez, among others. The students were frustrated that the texts by indigenous intellectuals from Brazil were not included. The study guide was designed exactly with this in mind, to bring the attention to the lack of publication by indigenous intellectuals in Brazil due to the policy of exclusion based on colonialism, and thus no indigenous intellectual is publicly acknowledged in their fields, as would be the case in Canada, Mexico, US, Australia, and New Zealand. Indigenous writers in Brazil explain that they are usually relegated to writing only children's books. If you want to write them, fine, but if that's your only option, that's something else. In Brazil, indigenous intellectuals are not invited to speak, write, or participate in activities that are not concerning indigenous issues. This begins to change very slowly due to pressure from the indigenous community. The participants in the workshop would be asked to interview their non-indigenous colleagues on campus about which issues are important to indigenous students at UFSCar. Their videotaped interviews was exhibited in the installation. This time the images were only of the non-indigenous students who were interviewed, because then I was trying to deal with the idea of, in the Brazilian situation, it is always a non-indigenous person with the mic in front of the indigenous person. So I wanted to go away from that. The students made a list of questions they wanted to ask. So what did, they asked this, their colleagues, what did they learn about indigenous peoples in school? What contributions are made by indigenous peoples? Have they ever met an indigenous person or visited a reservation? Were they aware that there were indigenous students at UFSCar? One black student answered that there had been no contributions made by indigenous peoples. Colonization is a process that makes us, those who have been colonized, wounded internally, and we must therefore also struggle very hard to decolonize ourselves. And there has been consistently, until very recently, no link between the black movement and the indigenous movement. So that's something that's happening very recently. The students also asked that there be ceramics installed in the university campus to bring more visibility to the indigenous community. The students chose areas where there was much activity, such as the library, the cafeteria, the buildings which house the Indigenous Students Association, and the main roundabout at the entrance of the campus. The last element of this work was two talks given by Eunice Augusto Martin and her daughter Potiporan Turibu Carlo from Tecoa Yute Reservation in São Paulo. Martin and Poran spoke about contemporary land struggles in the state of São Paulo at the plaza, where the statue of the killer founder of the city was. And then we continued to walk down towards the end of town at the other plaza where the founder of the military police was located. And it was an attempt to visibly reclaim the space of the city that refuses to acknowledge any indigenous people around there. But it was just a very strange timing. Just as we were leaving, this was happening. So this is the monument to the killer. And I don't know if you can see, okay, you can see it. This guy is photographing these two guys. These are pretend cowboys. They're gauchos, but they're like, there's these gaucho clubs and they dress up and then they have the big knives and, you know, they get on a horse once a year. They go do bonfires and they go out with a tent. And see here, so it's that whole cowboy myth thing, right? And they're photographing themselves in front of him. So, and you see what type of people they are looking like, right? Then there was the opening, and Maximino sent a letter that he wanted to be read aloud. And I will quote just a few parts. It was Dourados, Mato Grosso, September 9th, 2017. Dear Maria Teresa, to make the ceramics was a historical act for me, which involved remembering of beloved Guarani beings, many who have been lost during the century, but who have brought me strength and courage to confront these two moments. First, the concern with the retomada, that is a Portuguese word that means the retaking of the land. And there has been, this is the most violent state against indigenous people in Brazil. So in the retomada, there is now a land conflict. We were, our reservation was demarcated for 3,600 hectares, but 70 hectares are missing. We have 18,000 people and have a need of this land, which is in the hands of non-indigenous people. And it is now in hard confrontations, very violent confrontations, where 100 families are retaking these lands, and that's about 600 people. Even although we know that that is not sufficient land for us. The settlers support each other and accuse the Guarani of invading. To participate in the struggle brings me sadness as we live moments of pure aggression. We see our youth participating. We see fathers of families being gravely wounded and unable to buy bread for their family in the center of town. It's that type of very settler, racist town where if you go in and are obviously physically indigenous, you will not be able to buy a blanket in the store or bread. So you have to have network systems with non-indigenous people to acquire things in town, like go to the supermarket. So I welcome the opportunity to show the quotidian realities of the past, which happened as a result of the making of these ceramics, and of techniques which are almost forgotten today, but still in the memory of the living elders. This has given me strength to bring about a cultural center of Guarani memory, which would be a point of reference to indigenous schools and others.
You have been listening to Spill Radio.